For Love and Design, the podcast.
Welcome to For Love and Design, the podcast that explores the world of design, innovation, art, and creativity. I'm Ross Lovegrove, and together with Ila Colombo for this episode, we sat down with Peter Fiel, leading historian, author, and critic of design with a portfolio of over 60 written books on the subject of design. We'll be talking about what is the broader history of design and what has defined the dynamics of contemporary design and its impact on our world. But before we begin, if you enjoy our podcast, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. And don't forget to follow us on social media to stay up to date. Now, let's get started.
Hi, Ross. Hi, Peter. So nice to be with you today.
Nice to be here. Hello, hello. You've got a lovely place here, Ross.
Amazing. Well, Peter is going to be very excited to speak with you today. Again, like your partner, Charlotte, you're an incredible author and historian of design. And today we're going to talk about the broader history of design, which is a tapestry of human endeavor. It's where art meets function and imagination confronts the limitations of the physical world. When you look back, every era has had its own signature material, you could say, be it stone, iron, wood, or plastic. What do you think could be a defining material of the 21st century?
Well, I think the obvious defining material is silicon. But I have to say, I'm sorry, that the one that will leave the greatest legacy is plastic. And that's the material from the previous century. But we're only now really appreciating what the hell we did with that material, which is very, very sad.
Yeah.
And there isn't any kind of general desire to put a brake on it, it seems, especially across industry, because as the oil and gas industry is planning for, you know, winding down on the refining and production of gasoline for internal combustion engines, they're at the same time compensating for that by ramping up plastic production. And in particular, the most insidious kind, which is single-use disposable plastics. So I have a really good buddy that lives in Maui, actually used to live in Lahaina. He fortunately moved a couple of years ago, but he's one of the world's leading underwater photographers. And he told me recently that he had a buddy that was on an expedition and that they found plastic at the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Wow.
So that means plastic is right through the entire water column of our oceans. And that is a very, very, very sad thing. So I think that probably could be seen ultimately as the defining material of the 21st century. As far as others go, that may be slightly more hopeful than that, probably lithium.
Of course, of course.
Well, as Peter's talking there, and we've had a long-standing friendship, and we touch upon a lot of subjects when we get together, which really fascinates me. But it makes me embarrassed to be a designer when I hear that. Because I've participated in that realm, I've enjoyed using plastics, and there are often no alternatives, depends what it is. I mean, only the salvation that I get is by telling myself that I generally work on things which don't become obsolete. You know, I mean, a really good plastic chair that used, you know, my supernatural chair used to use like more than 30% less material in its day. Because that was an objective. So you might think, oh, it's a cool looking shape, but it's not about that. It's about this organic essentialism. It's about the reduction of mass, blah, blah, blah. The lightness promotes everything. It's good. So it's less. But it's still become, there's still an iconography, if you like, of association with a material that we have become so dependent on. And I'm very sensitive in the sense that I hate going into a supermarket. It changes me. It changes my skin on my body because I'm upset. I'm upset because I don't know where this ends. I mean, and you go there, every country in the world, everywhere, has got these damn supermarkets full of this instant delivery of whatever it is. And I don't know how that's going to be arrested.
Mm-hmm. I'm very pleased we started this episode going straight into a topic that we're all aware, but very few want to talk about, with seriousness and transparency. And you both mentioned not just the material, but parts and aspects of something that it's the very core of one of your books, which I actually have the pleasure to have, Plastic Dreams, and Ross's chair is on the cover of it. From what I could learn from the book is that you have a very deep understanding of the material and its good and bad sides of it. And historically, it did play a major part in design history. What's your view on non-single-use plastic today? And is a plastic chair good, or is the evil in the room?
Well, for sure, the most insidious type of plastic is single-use, but I also think plastic food packaging. I don't think we fully understood what the ramifications of the long-term use of that have been on the human species. Mm-hmm. I think there's a link to cancer, mm-hmm. and it's driving the cancer epidemic mm-hmm. in the population. Mm-hmm. If that were proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, then we could hold big oil responsible, like we held big tobacco responsible, for badly, badly affecting the human population. I think mm-hmm. there is a link. It needs to be proven. Mm-hmm. Other types of plastics, when used intelligently and responsibly, can be noble. Mm-hmm. And Ross has used plastic in a very, very noble way with the Supernatural chair, which, as I said the other day, is still one of my all-time favorite chairs, for the reason that it was largely process-driven, but made sexy. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if that's not a contradiction, okay? I mean, it was the most beautiful technology, gas assist injection molding. So that's less material, less energy, quicker cycle times. And it's been used in such a way that the chair will remain both functionally and aesthetically highly durable. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to use plastic, it's also single form, single material, which is also another great efficiency in the manufacturing process, right? You know, there are other chairs like that that you could claim are, you know, using plastic quite intelligently and demonstrating the nobility of the materials. Stark's polycarbonate furniture, for example. I mean, that's another example where plastic has been used intelligently and used in a way where probably it has a fairly long stylistic or aesthetic life expectancy.
Yeah, well, without plastic, we couldn't have been here today with the design, the diversity of design aesthetics that we have, you know. So it's we have a saying in Italy, don't spit in your own plate. But still, we need the wisdom and the capability of saying, well, that material served us so this far. Mm. Now is actually really good to maybe potentially stop it. Ross, directing to you and going into the innovation of design history in relation to materials, there is a say that innovation is seeing what everybody sees, but thinking what nobody has thought. In your own work, you have done this often over the years, at times even subconsciously. For you today, what's the next unthought of frontier?
The new level of innovation. I mean, you know, you're talking to somebody who, whatever they're presented with, I'll give it a go. So I've got this, I can make a go of a paperclip if you need to. I'll really try and give it something. Maybe that's not the point anymore. I think we need the invisible, metaphysical level of innovation, which is thought. It's really an innovation in thought. And then how does one look at the big systemic processes, the things that have massive impact on, you know, high-level production of anything. Why? I mean, why? And we have a factory system at the moment that pumps stuff out, not even knowing if they'll sell it. I mean, that's from clothes to whatever. It's ridiculous that there's no specific orientation of resources channeled. And for years, I've said there needs to be United Nations of resources, because we're all connected to that system. And if you got to the key of that in a political, geopolitical sense, maybe you could affect broader change. So I think it's all about the mandate. It's not really about the, you know, I've reached a point in my life existentially where maybe I just love the things around me that I have because they feel connected to me, but I'm not really thirsty for more. So it's a tough one. But if you said to me, innovate with furniture design, I'm using AI. I'm just going to press the button on that, because for me to woodenly try and pick my way through an idea is so ridiculous. I mean, it should be just, I should be challenged. I should be challenged by some other thing that is just doesn't go through this terrible, laborious irrelevance. Sorry, it's very, very strong.
Well, it's fascinating to try to imagine design history today of what's next to come. And obviously, we're not Nostradamus and we have a limit to how much we can predict. But Peter, you and Charlotte have quite clearly identified the fact that design has always been influenced by a strong socio-political environment of the design and the time of design that happened. Now, coming to today, as we stand on the precipice of climate change, AI and deep automation together with socio-political instability, can you think of how design could reflect our fears and hopes?
I would say the future of design is probably going to come down to how we harness AI. So potentially the human element will be taken out of the equation. And it may become necessary to do that because we're in a climate catastrophe. And it's going to get increasingly critical that we do something to try to save our sorry backsides. The Earth's going to be fine. The concern should be for the species. The Earth's going to survive. Mm-hmm. It was hit by a meteorite 65 million years ago, and everything worked out quite well, actually, for us. I think it's difficult to say how things might pan out with AI in terms of how it's applied to the design of things.
Mm-hmm. Give it a go.
Okay, I think it could be hyper-rational, super-functional, optimizing the use of materials so that we get absolutely the most with the least. Mm-hmm. Because that is really what the most logical approach, isn't it?
Yeah.
Any other approach is so totally unnecessary and really driven by what? Profit. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I'm concerned about AI as a technology. I'm in the same camp as Max Tegmark, who I consider one of the greatest minds alive right now. Super highly regarded. And, you know, he believes that we should put a brake on the development of AI until we catch up with it, the technology intellectually, and in terms of what we think about the morality of it.
I think young talents out there, they're feeling the vibes of everything we just said. And there might be questions that we're not asking just yet in relation to what a talent with a clear profession path might be asking himself or herself. We could be facing a life that prioritizes experiences, emotional, physical experiences over possessions, and that's really good because of what we just said. What are some of design questions that might fit into a life that is more experience, Ross, rather than physical possessions?
Well, that comes right from the inception of whatever age you are at and how you are being nurtured, mm-hmm, with the information that's put into that young mind. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why are we not using social media for a better end than we are, you know, instead of the pandemic that we see going out there? So why do we not use the tools that are really fundamentally in place now and they're not going away for an Earth-centric conversation? No Earth, no humans, no humans, happy Earth. And so I back up Pete completely on that. I don't mind being part of that statement. You know, so it's this thing, where does the real purpose lie? And I think it's all about education and awareness. And, you know, we live in an age where everything is out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. And it's become so convenient that, you know, it doesn't take much to have catastrophic failures in any of these systems. And we are cruising on mindlessly. And I don't want to be part of that. I prefer to be part of a thoughtful solution at any level from now on. I mean, so, you know, however that pans out. So if you're a young person optimistically wanting to go into the creative industries, you can be like somebody like Nick Knight, who can go into their garden, photograph the roses, bring it in, work with an app, and produce something unbelievably beautiful and of the moment. And it's almost virtual. So I think there are ways to express awareness, and there's other ways to get experience rather than going on a cruise liner or going here or going there and schlepping to an airport and the whole thing. There has to be a new way of engaging in life forms that are more virtual that mm-hmm. will help dematerialize this issue.
It's promoting the emotional side of design versus the material side.
Which is all
side.
Cerebral input. It's a sensual input.
Yeah. Well, still learning from your writing and books, Peter, we noticed that there's a cyclical nature of design trends. Retro styles often come back, albeit with modern twists, and that's fine. Do you think there's a danger in design nostalgia, or do you think there is any design nostalgia today? And is revisiting the past a crucial step for innovative leaps in design or not?
I think we can always learn from the past. I think it's essential that we learn from the past mistakes. And boy, oh boy, have we ever made some mistakes. So let's learn from them so that we can go forward, you know, more positively. All design solutions are fundamentally ephemeral. Mm-hmm. Because as needs and concerns change, so do our responses to them through design. So mm-hmm. what might be seen in one era mm-hmm. as highly rational may be seen as totally wasteful and stupid in another. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've got to accept the fact that there are very few permanent kind of like design solutions out there, and mm-hmm. that we have to be prepared to create something new and better. And that's probably what largely gets designers out of bed in the morning, knowing that there is almost always a better way of doing things. Mm-hmm. Now, if you factor in AI, though, now, I mean, that's another matter altogether, because, you know, there I can see an AI thinking, well, there's probably need for a more permanent type of solution to whatever the problem is that it's addressing. Mm-hmm. And that's taking out any sort of emotion mm-hmm. and expressiveness, okay? Mm-hmm. So then what you're limiting, what's being limited are the nature and the quality of the connections that can be made through whatever the design is. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I mean, I think that we've got to the point now where the sort of design solutions that we really need to be thinking about aren't the sorts where we're really worried about how it delights us or how we physically, you know, feel, you know, through the haptics of it or whatever. I think what we got to be thinking about are big, grand, like engineering design problems.
Fantastic. Well, Ross and I discussed something in the very first episode that sounded similar, like, why does the broader mainstream field of design feel like postmodernism and post-post-postmodernism and then modernism and then postmodernism coming back again? What you just said really resonates with me. How do you think we can positively communicate to the mainstream side of design that we need change?
Well, I mean, isn't it obvious already? Just think of the climate catastrophe. But, you know, how can we produce something that gives hope or that might lead to some kind of solution to begin solving that? I mean, our role as authors is to promote ideas and to get in people's heads and hopefully affect some kind of change for the better. This is why we're so interested in getting into China or returning to China. Because, I mean, there's a country where if you can get into the people's heads with some good ideas that are very persuasive and they buy into them, then you can affect some really big change. So that's why we're interested there. But I mean, what are you going to do with another chair? What ideas are you really communicating through something like that? I'm not saying that a chair is a banal thing. It's a really cool thing and hard to do properly. Mm-hmm. Ross is a master at designing cool chairs that do a great job. But, you know, maybe what we need to be thinking about more are different types of modes of light transportation, something like that, you know, or a new way of just making things more efficient. But, you know, the big engineering solutions that I alluded to before that are like massively required right now are things like carbon capture and storage. Okay, even if we achieved globally zero carbon emissions today, that's not enough. We've got to extract carbon and store it. And we need to do it on a massive scale, and we need to do it really, really soon. So that's a big engineering problem.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We were talking about retro. You mentioned that word retro, and which infuriates me, by the way, because I think we are a progressive, forward-leaning species, and with that comes innovation, 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 because innovation cleans things up. It's a form of life-centric improvement. So if you take that relative to the automotive industry, you know, when the retro thing was in full force, it was because petrol, oil was just, nobody was really talking about its impact. So it was a free-for-all. You know, you see it in fashion today, it's a free-for-all, and there's no thought behind it. So then you bring that up to date, and you talk about how you use resources wisely, and you talk about lightweight transport systems. Inevitably, if you look at the opportunities today from a design point of view with electric vehicles and intelligent awareness systems, which means they don't crash, they can be incredibly efficient, they can be part of a broader system using satellites and God knows everything. They don't need to be as they used to be. They could be made a different way out of new materials. And so it could be a polystyrene car because they're never going to touch each other. So it's a really fascinating moment, I think, to design, you know, but also thinking about in parallel with that, the broader implications of how we can reverse engineer, use geoengineering in a really intelligent way, develop new energy systems that are clean. I mean, this is where humans have to really step up. And I have faith because some of the people that we talk about and we know of have the intellect to step up. Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, they've got a lot of resistance, but I have faith in that regard, even if it just extends our life on the planet long enough to think it through.
Fantastic. Yeah, totally agree. Peter, you mentioned, for obvious reason, the 20th century as something where we might have done something wrong and we have the wisdom now of understanding, for example, the impact of plastic. If there's another era or movement from the past that we should delve into, not for inspiration, but rather introspection, which one would it be and why?
That's easy. The Age of Aquarius. That's the summer of love to the oil crisis, 1967 to 1972. What an incredibly magic time that was. And I'm so unbelievably grateful that that's when I grew up. Because although there were some bad things happening in the background, not least the Vietnam War and the Cultural Revolution in China, both horrendous, there were some really incredibly powerful and optimistic things that were happening. Just think of the space program, the whole Apollo mission, the moon landing in 1969, and everything that followed from that. But there was also something huge happening in society that we refer to as the counterculture, that believed in a new way of living that was more in harmony with the earth. It was the birth of the green movement, right? Mm-hmm. Greenpeace was formed in like 1971 or 1972, very near where I was at university. But there were other things going on, like, for example, Buckminster Fuller, Ross's all-time heroes, one of my all-time heroes, because he was just this genius polymath. He was a mathematician, he was a futurologist, he was an architect, and he came up with this idea that I think still holds so much water. And that is that we are all passengers on spaceship Earth.
I love it.
Okay? If you think that we're on this spaceship hurtling through the cosmos, what are we doing fighting wars? I mean, come on. I mean, for God's sakes, here we are in the 21st century. We're all passengers sharing the same destiny. Why are we still like Neanderthals? Anyway, there were other things that were going on that were really cool that reflected this spirit of optimism that Buckminster Fuller was talking about. And that was like the advent of things like the Whole Earth Catalog. Oh my God, what a thing that was. I mean, that was like a magazine that was published from, I think, 1968 to about 1972, 73. Largely about products needed to survive, okay, off-grid mainly. It was about DIY, it was about holism, it was about alternative ways of living, and so on and so on. And I tell you what, I would start collecting them now because they would still be very useful. It wasn't just that they were a catalog of useful products, but there were like incredibly useful ideas as well that were being propounded through it. And Steve Jobs' famous 2005 graduation speech at Stanford, he quoted extensively from the Whole Earth Catalog, and in fact ended the speech with a quote from the back of the first copy.
Wow.
Yeah, and also there was a very famous image called Earthrise, which featured on the cover, and it was taken by Jim Lovell on Apollo 8. The first time the human species looked back on themselves and saw this marble, this beautiful, beautiful blue marble, how super special it is in the overall cosmos. That's our home. And it was the first time we saw it from a distance. And oh my God, I tell you, that's one of the most powerful images. That's maybe my most favorite image ever. And what are we doing to our home?
Yeah, well, I can sense that Ross is in a deeply emotional state at the moment. You know, for one of his birthday, I got him also one of the very first picture of the Earth from space. It was not the Apollo, it was the Russian mission, and it was just from the upper layer of the atmosphere. So it was not the full Earth, but it was just a portion of it that I got at auction. But no, what you just said really deeply resonates with us both. And I think it's one of those unspoken parts of Ross's philosophy and profession that he hasn't been able to fully satisfy. You know, is this rational versus emotional? Is the wisdom versus, you know, everything else? And being in a profession that promotes creativity, but also the commercial side of creativity, it's very difficult to find a positive compromise.
What you just said really got me deep, partly because it's all about this damn cause and effect. And, you know, if you look at the Earth from space now, it's like a printed circuit board. It's like it's full of light and it's an electronic Earth. It's changed radically from those early days. And I gave a talk with an astronaut recently, and he said, I asked him what he felt when he looked at the Earth from space. And he said he finally found his soul, because he realized that being part of the Earth is what being soulful or having a soul is. And I just thought that was kind of incredible. And that's why we do often refer to indigenous peoples for some kind of wisdom, you know, even though we ride roughshod over all of that. But, you know, the thing that troubles me just very quickly is that we bullishly go forward with projects thinking that we can solve the problem by doing more. But, you know, sometimes you need to do less. I have a slow burn as a designer, meaning I just need to get a balance between what I'm engaged in and how my family unit runs without being excessive. I want to use my input for greater things, better things, if I can, if that's possible. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's still, it's all more, more, more. And, you know, this thing about a halt on AI is one thing, but there needs to be a pullback. And I think there are surreptitious forces out there which say one thing and do another. They're cheating on themselves. And it's really, it's not even the word sad, you know. So I think there's a, for anybody that's got deeper, deeper knowledge and emotions, this is a really, it's a fight or flight moment, I think.
You know? Well, on the spiritual side of all that we mentioned, we not so long ago met someone that is like, she's not an astrologist and she's not an astronomer, obviously, but she deals with star readings and kind of like future sightseeing of humanity. And she mentioned something that we being so far, you know, everything is cyclical, and we've been so far in a very male period of humanity, and we're gonna start entering the feminine side of humanity. I don't know the deep meaning of that, but I like the sound of it, because obviously I'm a woman and I represent a minority within an industry that is male dominated. And in June I gave a lecture at Design Shanghai about artificial intelligence, and I was really trying to promote female figures within not just design, but also technology. And I brought up an article that I stumbled upon named Untold History of AI, Invisible Women Programmed America's First Electronic Computer. Now, Peter, you're like an encyclopedia of design history. Is there any untold women of design history which we should really look at?
Well, the one that immediately springs to mind is Susan Carr.
Hmm.
Who came up with the idea of using icons for an operating system Or at least if she didn't come up with the idea, she designed them, you know, so like the bomb and the little compact disc representing a hard drive and all the ones that Apple launched their first, you know, home type Apple II desktop computer. That operating system that was so intuitive to use was based on the use of these, I think they're called skeuomorphic icons or whatever.
And that was a woman.
That was a woman, yeah. And she doesn't get credited nearly enough for what she did. I mean, Charlotte, in her book that she wrote with our youngest daughter, Clementine, featured her very largely in the text for that very thing. But I mean, there have been women, you know, throughout the history of design that have been involved in like the automotive industry that have done really cool things. Okay, it, you know, they may be in the industry, but it's not been feminized, if you know what I mean. It's still a male-dominated industry, but they're in it and doing some interesting things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I strongly believe that some of the problems that we face as a society today is because there are not enough women at the power positions. You need, you know, it's the yin and the yang. You need chaos and you need order, you need feminine, you need male. And when you have just one point of view, whether it's, you know, the left hemisphere of the brain or the right hemisphere of the brain, you need both.
I mean, my take would be the acute understanding that for the reality of a situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really interesting. And as I'm saying that to you, I see a few images of brands and things that come up in my mind that would get demolished by a female creative mind that would just ask the most direct questions that all the blokes would think, she's got to go, you know. And I think we need that. We need that kind of maternal instinct, Mother Earth, Venus identity. So bringing them to the fore is not just a political act. It's really something that's more Earth. You talk about First Nations, and more now they keep finding burials, certainly in Europe, of really powerful women who were as powerful as other chieftain leaders, you know. So we know that the male ego and the male forcefulness, the grunt of that, is the root of a lot of problems.
Mm. Mm. I would just add to that, my hope is that we do have more feminine dominance of the status quo, because what is so concerning is what's driving forward technologies that are clearly not in our best interests.
Yeah, precisely.
Okay, so what is the driver? It's corporate greed, ultimately. So we need more females in there to kind of rein back that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of AI specifically, I mean, my big concern is the first thing that's going to happen is it's going to be weaponized.
Yeah, which is a very direct use of the technology already. So interestingly, another point I want to touch upon now that we're in back to AI is the democratization of design, especially with the advent of open source platforms, DIY movements, which you also mentioned, Peter. Ross, how do you see this democratization of tools, platforms, influencing professional design practices today? Is there a risk of a more inclusive creativity thanks to AI, for example, eventually flatlining human curiosity and genius?
It can't flatline curiosity. I mean, that's silly. Charlotte said earlier, you know, she said everybody's a designer, you know, everybody has a creative side to them. So that idea of creativity being sidelined by some new technology, all it does is it squeezes the balloon and out pops the inertia in another dimension. It's like parallel worlds. So there might become this sort of multiverse of creativity. So the democratization of that is something which is inevitable. I mean, that's everybody's got themselves a nice smartphone, and that's democracy on steroids, you know. I find that on the one hand a bit depressing, but on the other hand I find that very exciting, because it levels it. And if you want to have an inertia of some kind of logic, or again, existential reconnect back to life on a planet. Ironically, I think we have to go into this sort of extreme dislocated artificial dimension in order then to come back and challenge the corporate norm, which is such an old-fashioned idea anyway. It's a dominant thing. So democracy, I think, whatever that really means, will numbers of people thinking the same way. It's what I call global consciousness. It's nothing to do with popular culture.
Mm-hmm. Back to design history, Peter. You mentioned Buckminster Fuller as one of your absolute all-time favorites. You're now working on different subjects, for example, a book on watches and clocks, which sounds really interesting, going through the entire history of those beautiful objects. Is there a particular object that you would call throughout history a design genius?
That's a very big question, and I'd have to reflect really hard on that to come up with a sensible answer. But I think just off the top of my head, I would say probably the most transformative genius product so far has been, as Ross has just said, is the cell phone. I mean, it's astonishing. Wherever you go in the world, if you're on the underground system and it's packed full of people, they're all head down looking at their bloody phone. And I swear, you know, when I'm in Shanghai and I'm on the underground system there, I'm the only person not looking at a phone.
And we're talking about a smartphone, not just a phone.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Because
that's
there
it,
were exactly. mobile phone before Steve Jobs. The smartphone.
That's right. A smartphone is what I meant. Not cell phone, smartphone. That, to me, because there's such a convergence of technology there that rendered all sorts of product types irrelevant, like the camera, you know, and the voice recorder and so on and so forth. The calculator and the calendar. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I mean, that is phenomenal.
Yeah, as you're speaking, you know, I have goosebumps.
I'm thinking
about the presentation of Steve Jobs of the smartphone and the first iPhone.
I mean, what an incredible visionary guy he was. I still think he's not fully, totally rated to the extent that he should be. I think he was just some extraordinary human being that comes along every once in a while, you know, on par with like Thomas Edison.
Yeah, but I think that's an absolute metaphor for everything that we're talking about, meaning you set up an ultimate goal. I mean, you push the boundaries right out there and then you find a way to work it out. So the smartphone, as let's even call it the Apple phone because nothing comes close, is an ongoing, rationalized and optimized object. I mean, that's dealing with resources, globalism, blah, 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 languages, the whole thing. Maybe it goes into a holographic situation. I mean,
human-centric
design. It's an amazing singular element that represents our capability. And I find, I mean, that's the pinnacle of it all, isn't it? Mm-hmm. After everything that we're talking about. And it takes one man to coerce other people who don't even think that way, into doing it. Why can't we do that with everything, from geoengineering through to everything else that we're talking about?
Exactly.
You know, America spent $3 trillion in Afghanistan. That's a lot of money. I mean, why are we even thinking about money when, in fact, we got such an issue? I mean, you just do it, don't you? I mean,
well, Max Tegmark's identified what it is, and it's a monster called Molark.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's like driving things forward, even though we know that's bad and it's the wrong way to go. And what's the motivation? Mm-hmm. Corporate greed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. When we know that. Now I'm going to go direct from going through some questions that came through both of your audiences. Peter, what is the recommended guide or approach for implementing intelligent manufacturing to state-of-the-art design?
It all comes down to morality, ultimately, and what you feel is the right moral approach as a designer and also as a manufacturer. It's agreeing on what is the best way of doing things and what is in most people's interests over what's in our shareholders' interests, okay? This is what I was alluding to. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, I mean, I kind of hate to say this, that I think free market capitalism is going to be seen as one of the worst things ever invented by the human species. Because so many of our problems are the direct result of it. But on the other hand, there are companies that have the right motivations, that, you know, enlist the right sort of genius type people, you know, designers and engineers, and, you know, try to do something that's truly innovative that makes things better. And, you know, more often than not, those are the most profitable companies. You know, when I say that sort of thing to an audience of Chinese people in China, that really wakes them up. Mm-hmm. It's like history has shown that the most profitable course of action more often than not is doing the right thing, whatever the hell that is, okay? Mm-hmm. So I think if there's a way that we can synthesize and reconcile the use of artificial intelligence with the right kind of like controls, okay, that may be the best, probably will be, hopefully, the best way forward in terms of coming up with the right sort of solutions that we need to all the problems that exist. And it's an ever-growing list. And it's never bigger, you know, the problems are getting larger scale.
Well, AI could bring us true democracy.
Yeah, I strongly believe in that. Mm-hmm. Ross, this is directed to you. How do you craft your own unique philosophy in design and how do you scale it?
I craft my own unique philosophy because I don't like design. I have a problem with it. I see it as a potential enemy because I don't want to overly profit individually from the demise of natural resources and so on. So I have always, every moment I touch anything, I've got this, I'm ripped apart through, you know, degree of ethics and morality and not even that really, but more the kind of awareness of whether my actions would be of any consequence anyway. You know, we talk about Steve Jobs. I mean, wow, I mean, yeah, if you've got such a ruthless goal and you just are determined, then great. But how do you get out of bed really feeling that whatever it is that you're doing is really of any consequence? I mean, it's really tough, I have to say. So I have my own guiding principles, which are, they evolve and they become kind of reconsidered. But surely making something with less material, that's got to be a benefit. I mean, it's a benefit for everybody, you know. So, I mean, that one, I'm never going to give that one up, am I? I mean, I'm just going to scrape away as much as I can.
Well, thank you both for today, guys.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Thanks, Peter. Thank you for joining us on this episode of For Love and Design. We hope you enjoyed listening to our conversation. If you want to keep exploring the world of design, innovation, art, and creativity, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. We would love to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes too. And don't forget to follow us on social media to stay up to date with our latest news and announcements. Until next time.